are only so many stories to be told. Sooner or later, things start sounding the same. So when it comes to originality, the trick is not what story you tell, but how you tell it. Hi, I'm Dan Webster, host of Movies 101. And in this week's show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I will discuss three films, each boasting international credentials, and each marked by its own unique storytelling style. So don't touch that dial, because another edition of Movies 101 is coming up next, right here on Spokane Public Radio.
Free your radio and hear Spokane Public Radio wherever you go when you listen live on your mobile phone, tablet, or computer at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Just click on Listen Live, pick your station, and start listening. Tune in anytime for NPR programs, local news, music, public affairs, arts news, and more at KPBX, KSFC, or KPBZ. You can listen to all three live from our website by clicking the blue Listen Live link at the top. Whichever station you choose, SPR travels with you, keeps you company, and keeps you in touch with the world. Visit SpokanePublicRadio.org and listen live.
Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that boasts originality in at least one big area, anniversaries. We're just about to end our 20th year of being on the air, which isn't bad for something that Bob Glatzer and I started in 1999 on a whim. Bob passed away in 2010, but the show has soldiered on largely due to the capable talents of my two partners, Nathan and Mary Pat. And we plan on reviewing films for as long as Spokane Public Radio will have us, which will be at least through this week as we tackle three new films, all of which we saw in theaters, and all of which tell stories in distinctly non-mainstream ways. One was the German-French production Transit, another is the American effort The Mustang, and the last one is the Chinese offering Ash is Purest White. Let's begin with a film that feels a bit unstuck in time. Based on a 1944 short story, German director Christian Petzold's film Transit has the feel of Casablanca, as told by the late science fiction writer Philip K. Dick. Our protagonist, Georg, is dodging fascist troops, though he is doing so in France, and not during World War II, but in what looks to be modern day. Just as confusing is the fact that Georg's native language is German, even if everyone around him is as French as a brie-smeared baguette. Causing confusion, though, is how Georg hopes to survive, as through chance he assumes the identity of a dead writer, an act born of necessity, and one he may be able to parlay into an exit visa and, shades of Humphrey Bogart, letters of transit. Complicating matters, the writer's widow shows up looking for her spouse and unaware either of his death or of Georg's duplicity. Transit includes a subtext that echoes one of the world's most pressing current problems, that of desperate immigrants looking for refuge, and it does give us something of a love story, but it refuses to blunt its narrative by resorting to anything resembling a feel-good finale.
So this movie, Transit, was directed, as you said, by Christian Petzold, and his last film was a movie called Phoenix, which I don't know if you recall this, but I loved Phoenix. I think
it was
number two or three in my top 10 list that year. I think it's one of the great films of the last decade, and I hope that people discover that movie because it's really something. It has a lot in common with this one. Transit, both movies are about mistaken identity. Both movies are about war and the aftermath of war. World War II in Phoenix, this one, it's kind of unclear as to what's actually happening, although the story that it's based on was originally written during World War II. And both are about these noirish plot contrivances working both in these characters' favors but also working against them, as if fate is playing a joke upon them, essentially. And while I thought that it was almost operatic in intensity in Phoenix, I found Transit a letdown. This movie just never got started for me. I sat there waiting for the inevitable to happen, which was the same case in Phoenix, although in Phoenix I was on the edge of my seat and I was completely wrapped up in the story, whereas here I felt at a remove from it, both emotionally and just in terms of like on a narrative level. I just never really got wrapped up in the story. You're just waiting for the truth, the horrible truth, to finally come out. You just want this guy to just admit what's going on. The wife thinks that her husband is somewhere in this village, but it's actually him. It's way more complicated than I'm willing to explain. And you're just waiting for everyone to just be miserable in the end, because that's basically what this director does. And normally I'm on board more than I was here. And there are so many plot contrivances in Transit that I think might have worked if the style of the filmmaking kind of matched this sort of old-fashioned mode of storytelling, because like you said, it's from a 40s story, but it's been transplanted to now, I guess. And the decision to do that seems a bit dodgy to me. I mean, I guess he's talking about the universality of the immigrant experience and the fact that we are still dealing with fascism in various ways. But by making it so vague, like, we never really know what exactly is happening in the world at large. I don't know. And it felt like a gimmick to me.
I think that's what caused the disconnect, because as you said, you're so busy trying to figure out what the narrative is. I think he should have just thrown down and acknowledged that this was modern times, as obviously it's set in modern times in terms of the cars and the scenery and the attire for the most part.
But then people are using typewriters and
he should have gone all in with that. Because I think it would have worked better. At one point I leaned over to Dan and I said, am I getting dementia, because I can't really figure out who's who and what's what.
I had the same problem.
You finally just had to sort of let go of it and say, I'm just going to let this roll over me. I'm going to take it for what it is. And I did really appreciate the acting performances again. I think that Franz Rogowski, who plays our Georg, our primary character, is a very compelling screen presence. We see this mysterious woman coming and going at various points, and then her identity is finally revealed in Transit, the movie. But I agree, Nathan, I think it lost some of its oomph in contrast to Phoenix because of these multiple problems and difficulties that you mentioned.
I think I like this movie, Transit, more than either of you. Obviously, it has problems. For the first half hour, I could not figure out what was going on. But ultimately, when it was over, I had to really sit and think about it. And it's like I was mentioning in the lead-in to this week's show, there are only so many stories to tell. I mean, this is Casablanca. This is a variation on the Casablanca.
Basically.
It's
set primarily in a bar, and the bartender turns out to be our narrator. The voiceover.
Oh, you gave it away.
Oh, come on.
And well, it could also be Richard III in its modern incarnation.
Or like the one they made with Ian McKellen.
Right. Exactly. That's what I'm talking about.
But the other thing, too, is that it smacks of Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle, in which Germany and Japan won World War II, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah, there is like a speculative historical fiction thing kind of going on.
Which is what I think he was trying to do, because he says, I've got the same old story here, but I'm going to try to throw people off by doing this. And you called it a gimmick. I call it a refreshing way of trying to reinvent a story that doesn't completely work.
Okay.
Because I agree with Mary Pat, he should have gone hog wild and made a sci-fi film.
He seems to be waffling a bit. So I'm going to challenge you on that. By making this story, which is clearly a World War II story. I mean, it's Casablanca right from the beginning. I mean, I picked up on that.
Right.
How does it benefit this film to set it in more or less a modern day setting? What does it add to it? How does it change anything?
Because the only difference is it's not clearly wartime during this movie. So I think that if we were going to make parallels to what's happening with the alt-right across the world and so forth and so on, it's not clearly wartime. Maybe that point, which we all got anyway, would have been clearer. But you're right. I'm not sure that in the end that's dispositive of anything.
I mean, I guess it throws off our equilibrium a little bit.
Exactly. I think what he's doing is he's challenging
us. It's disorienting.
He's challenging us to look at this in a new way. And like I said, I don't think it's a complete success. I ended up liking it more than either of you, but I think I ended up liking it because at least pencil the writer-director, took a brave step to try to do something different, and it doesn't quite work. And I'll always give a filmmaker credit for trying to do something different.
I look at this story of Transit, and I want to go back to Phoenix. I don't want to compare the two because other than some of the basic themes and the fact that they share a writer-director, it didn't have as much as in common as I thought it was going to, because when I read the logline for this movie, I thought, well, that sounds an awful lot like Phoenix. That was a film, if you recall, where a woman basically had cosmetic surgery because of, I mean, it sounds ridiculous, but it totally works. She had cosmetic surgery because of an injury she suffered during the war, and so she has a totally new face. And she goes back to confront her ex-husband, who thinks that she's dead, and discovers that he's basically trying to embezzle her from her fortune because he's trying to basically get the will.
He's trying to use her to do
it. But he sees her and thinks, you look an awful lot like my dead wife. And so she gets involved in this
scheme. I know, it's a classic.
And it's totally ridiculous if you think about it too long. But he's able to conjure up the style both in the performances and in the cinematography that you go with it because it feels like an old noir film or a 1940s melodrama that you'd get caught up in. This is much more reserved in pretty much every way, but the story is just as outlandish if you really think about it too much. Just the whole notion that this woman keeps running into this guy who just happens to have the identity of her dead husband, and she doesn't know he's dead.
And she keeps mistaking him from the behind for her husband and then looks at him.
Right.
And after about the third time, I began thinking, I think she knows more than
I don't think she does because
you just, sometimes you want something to be true.
I think that's part of what was going on here. It was just there were too many contrivances
here. I just wanted it to make
here.
Sense. That's what I was going for.
I mean,
in the end, I settled for what it presented.
Just go back and watch Phoenix because it's so much better than
this.
The Transit continues to play, so go see that first. And that was Transit. This is Movies 101, and it's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts of Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at The Mustang and Ash is Purest White. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
You must remember this. A kiss is just a kiss. A sigh is just a sigh. The fundamental things apply as time goes by. And when two lovers woo, they still say I love you. On that you can rely.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discuss the German-French film Transit. Let's now move to an American film that features a French director and a Belgian actor, followed by the Chinese production Ash is Purest White. That French director is Laure de Clermont-Tonnerre, and the Belgian actor is, and I always have trouble pronouncing this, Matthias Schoenaerts. The film is The Mustang, which de Clermont-Tonnerre team wrote based on a simple idea. A violent man teams with a wild horse, and both find, well, if not redemption, then at least a sense of renewal. Even though based on a real situation and filmed in the scenic area where the state prison sits in Carson City, Nevada, the resulting story could have been rendered as a simplistic morality tale, but through sheer filmmaking skill, taking advantage of the majestic landscape and the riveting screen presence of her lead actor, de Clermont-Tonnerre lets the story unveil in a measured way that feels as powerful as the animals, both human and horse, whose story she is attempting to portray.
There have been previews shown of The Mustang for several months, and so I didn't really know what to anticipate or expect if what I saw in the previews is all we were going to get. Fortunately, that's not true. But Dan, I agree with you. This teeters on being a Lifetime movie at various points. Right. And it pulls it back. It pulls it back just as it's about to tip over the edge, in my opinion. First of all, I would tell people to see this in the theater because I do think that the landscapes and the vistas that you see on the outside are in such stark contrast to what the horse and the man are dealing with being incarcerated.
Especially since, he is a prison inmate. I didn't point that out. He's in prison. So consequently, when he gets out, that sense of claustrophobia is like, wow, look at those mountains.
Right. And I think that seeing it on the big screen is essential for that purpose. I think here, the filming itself, I thought, was really well done in
especially
terms
that
of the
opening scene.
Right, in terms of the action shots. I know we have drones, we have all these other equipment, the things where you can chase the horses and so forth and so on. But from a viewer's perspective, it was spectacular. And Dan, as you mentioned, Matthias Cordiarts, I think is actually the Flemish pronunciation, is one of those screen presences that you cannot take your eyes off of. I mean, so throughout this entire movie, I was a little skeptical. He's played these sort of tough, buff, rough characters before, but he did a masterful job. And so I think his name is Roman. And I think I would tell people to go see this movie. I mean, I think it's more than a morality tale. It's beautiful and it's extremely well acted.
Yeah, and I went into The Mustang very skeptical because, I mean, even just from the trailers, as you said, Mary Pat.
Especially from the trailers.
The
yes.
central metaphor of this movie is just so obvious. I mean, just the way in which the man and the horse are the same thing. I mean, Roman, because I don't want to try and butcher the actor's name either. Roman, he even breathes like the horse. He's got these kind of like halting, gruff breaths. And you're like, okay, I get it. He's just like the horse. He can't be tamed. And he has all this
some
aggression.
Some horses can never be broken.
Yeah, and I just thought, oh, brother.
What about Bruce Dern?
And honestly, it doesn't have anything new to say about masculinity, about prison reform, about man's relationship to nature, about forgiveness, about redemption. And yet somehow this works. I almost like in spite of all of its problems, it works. And I think it's because of that central performance, because he is such a physical presence and he has been in so many movies, and yet he's never really played the same character twice. I think this role is the closest he's played to his breakout role in Bullhead,
yeah. Right.
Where he played a guy, this roided out guy mm-hmm. who was taking out all of his inner demons
fighter,
out
yeah.
on himself. And he's this big hulking guy, but he has these really tender eyes, and just the way that he acts with his face and his body is amazing. And I have to say that as he gets to know this horse and as the horse warms to him, I found myself getting emotionally involved in this more than I thought I would. And I honestly think much of it has to do with the acting. And we can talk about the supporting performances too.
Right, including Bruce Dern, who's terrific.
Right.
I mean, he's Bruce Dern, but he also adds just the right kind of Walter Brennan style to this movie. But I want to go back and just make a case for the director, because what she does with a script that is probably about 17 pages long, she has these long, lingering shots of the horses. And we've made the point, right when she tips up to, oh my God, she's going to go into total cliche, she will let the film just go on. It's masterful filmmaking. I've never heard of this woman before. I hope she does something else. I hope she has a better script to work with next time, because she could make a great film as opposed to something that's just merely good.
I mean, this is the third Man and His Horse movie that we've gotten in the last year and a half or so, because we had Lean on Pete by Andrew Hay, and we had Chloe Zhao's The Rider, which I think of the three is without question the best. I think this is probably the least of those three, honestly. I think you're probably higher on it than I am. But I have to say that in terms of just the challenge of overcoming the maudlin potential of the Mustang, the challenge was greater here, I think. And at the end of the movie, when they're – because the whole idea is they're breaking these wild stallions so that they can then be auctioned off to ranch hands and border patrolmen and things like that. When it actually comes time for these horses to be auctioned off and you see that these men really have had these emotional bonds with these animals, it is affecting.
Yeah.
And then, of course, it always gets me every time when they show real photos of people at the end of a fact-based movie, and it always gets me. So this one sneaked up on me, but I'm glad that it did.
Mm-hmm. And that was The Mustang. Let's close with the Chinese film Ash is Purest White, which you have to admit is an intriguing title, though it isn't what Chinese director Zhang Kezhia originally called it. His title translates to something like Sons and Daughters of Jianggu, the Jianggu being both a kind of outlier criminal brotherhood and the code to which that brotherhood adheres. Zha's principal characters are Xiao and Bin, Xiao played by director Zha's wife Zhao Tao, and Bin by Liao Fan. Bin is the big brother, the head of a group that runs gaming and other unsavory businesses, and Xiao is his lover and seeming equal. But things change when Bin is challenged, Xiao saves him, and because of her action, is sent to prison. When she is released, she goes in search of Bin, only to find he has moved on. In some ways, Zha's film unfolds like a travelogue, capturing the development of a modern China in much the same way as his 2006 film Still Life, especially with sequences referring to the Three Gorges Dam project that caused the displacement of numerous cities, towns, and villages, and more than a million people. Ultimately, though, Zha's story is one of loyalty, both to a person and to a code that, reflecting the purity that volcanic heat can produce, may be as outdated as anything not relevant to a modern China.
I have to admire a movie that, in the span of 2 hours and change, can really make me feel like I've experienced the whole of a person's life, or at least a good chunk of a person's life. And I think this movie, Ashes Purest White, does that. It has something of a novelistic kind of sweep to
sure
it
does,
because
yes,
we
does.
Get
a Russian novelistic.
We get about what 15 years in the lives of these two people. It's essentially three acts in their lives, particularly the woman, and we see this kind of cyclical thing happening. And while all of this is going on in their lives, it's happening in China too. It's happening around them, and the country itself almost seems to mirror the ways that their positions in
it's
life kind of
ebb
and flow. It's
almost as much a character as they are.
I hate that cliche, but yes, you're right. And I think that the way that Zha juxtaposes their lifestyles, especially in the early sections of the film where we see them out at nightclubs dancing to such current hits as YMCA by the Village People, which I guess it would take a while to
yes,
get to China, wouldn't
yeah,
it? Because
yeah.
it starts in 2001 or 2002
something like that, yeah.
and then ends in modern day. But how it juxtaposes their lifestyles with this more conservative, traditional China. And yet none of it plays out in obvious way or a hectoring way. I could also see a filmmaker maybe wanting to punish these characters because they are criminals. But he has this empathy towards them, trying to figure out why they are the way that they are, that I found really moving. And there's this entire middle segment where it's just her, where she has lost everything and she's reintegrating back into society, trying to use all of the tricks that she learned in the criminal underworld to try and get herself back up onto her feet after trying to live an honest life fails her. And that segment alone, it's probably 45 minutes of the movie, and it ends with this confrontation between the two characters. They've been separated for years in this hotel room, and in this one long, unbroken shot, we see all of these things come back to the surface.
Right.
It's you talk about masterful filmmaking in the last film.
Yes.
I think this is masterful filmmaking. And I have to be honest, Zha's filmography is a blind spot for me. I've looked up some of his other films.
You saw Still Life.
I didn't know.
Yeah.
And if I did, I don't recall it. So as far as I know, this is the first film of his that I've seen. A few of his movies are streaming now, so I'm going to go back and watch them. But if they're as good as this, I'm really excited to get into his filmography.
Yeah. Well, I want to make the point that when I was talking about the other film, The Mustang, is great filmmaking. The caveat is great visual filmmaking. This is great narrative, literary, visual.
Emotional filmmaking.
Exactly. Acting, thespian filmmaking.
Cultural filmmaking, too, because the way that he photographs these various places in China and shows how they change over the course
without
of these
making
years.
Making overt commentary at all.
Right.
It's this is happening, folks. Here it is.
The way that these villages and provinces crumble under socioeconomic ruin and then get rebuilt again, but without any character, these kind of government-mandated building projects.
Right.
I think it mirrors what the characters are struggling to do in the film.
Especially and
it
live
works
up to this
so well.
Code, this
yeah.
omerta that,
right.
that they have, that she grasps and that Ben clearly never did.
And the movie ends in a way that it reminded me of one of Linklater's before movies, in the sense that I could see these characters coming back in 10 years, and I'd like to see what they're up to again.
And I need to add very quickly, this movie is going to be playing through this weekend at the Magic Land, and then it's going.
It's
so
really
good. Go see it. And that was Ashes Purest White, and this is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster, and earlier in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed Transit and The Mustang. Let's take this moment to thank Jim Tevenin for both producing and engineering the show, and we thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again try to separate cinema wheat from cinema chaff. Until then, remember this quote from the great Alfred Hitchcock. If it's a good movie, the sound could go off and the audience would still have a perfectly clear idea of what was going on. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.